From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. 10 years ago, Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater launched a little musical called Hairspray. We're going to talk with the Fifth Avenue's David Armstrong about the impact of that musical on the theater itself. On the first day of the Paris Air Show, Boeing is announcing 10 new orders for its 787-10X. The newest version of the Dreamliner would seat more passengers than previous versions. But big question, where will this airplane be built? The Seattle Times reports from Paris that Boeing Commercial Airplanes Chief Ray Conner was noncommittal when asked if Boeing would build the 10X in Everett. Joining us now, not from Paris, he's in California, is Guy Norris, senior editor at Aviation Week. Hi, Guy.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
I don't know. Is it good that you're not in Paris or bad?
Well, that's a very good question. I've been watching tweets from my colleagues there, and they're saying that it's more like Bangladesh in the monsoon right now. So I'm kind of happy to be back in California at the moment.
Okay, good. Well, then you'll have to just tell us from your perspective from afar what is actually going on. My colleague, Carolyn Adolf, reported just before you came on the air that the Airbus sort of threw down the gauntlet and said, this is our plane, and now it's up to Boeing to say, you know, I see your big jet and match you.
Exactly.
Raise you, I guess.
Right. Yeah, it's a fascinating time, actually, because, you know, these developments take, as you know from following yourself, they take years and years to come to fruition with each of these developments and extended fuselage-type stretch programs. But to actually get to the stage where you literally fly it days before the beginning of a show is an amazing coincidence. Obviously, a little bit of timing probably involved in that scheduling. But to, as far as sort of flying the flag is concerned for Airbus, it was an amazing piece of timing. Of course, Boeing has its opportunity to do exactly the same thing because it is in a position right now to officially launch the -10X, the next stretch development of the 787, actually at the show. It's just a question of corralling the right amount of launch customers at the time within the next few days, literally.
How much is the Paris Air Show a big marketplace, and how much is it a show?
Well, it's an interesting thing. From the commercial airlines perspective, it's a massive event. You know, it's the biggest one in the world. It's bigger than Farnborough and Singapore, Dubai. From a defense perspective, probably less so, and particularly this year, from the U.S. perspective, as you know, sequestration and other aspects have held back U.S. participation. But from a commercial perspective, it's the biggest show in the world, you know, and this is it. It's sort of showtime, literally, for all of the manufacturers.
This is an air show, the biggest in the world, held in the backyard, sort of backyard of Airbus. I believe Airbus is headquartered in Lyon. It's not that far away. So do they have home field advantage?
Yes. I mean, it's actually Toulouse in the southwest of France. But they do have, obviously, as you quite rightly say, it's in their backyard, essentially. And you do get the feeling that, you know, they make the most of it, which is why it's very, very intriguing that for the second year running, Boeing, which has a long tradition of not flying airliners at the show, is going to be putting the 787 through its paces. And they had a very successful flight demo with the 787 at Farnborough last year. And they were so, I think, pretty well overwhelmed by the response to that, that they're doing the same thing again this year. So it's kind of Boeing sort of raised its game, essentially, to meet Airbus's challenge. Airbus has always done a fantastic job of flying their fly-by-wire aircraft, you know, displaying them at the shows too. So it's very interesting that you're sort of getting like for like in this sort of heavyweight punching match, you know.
We're talking with Guy Norris, senior editor at Aviation Week. Didn't Boeing need to fly a 787 after the grounding and the rejiggering of the batteries?
Well, again, that's a very good point. In fact, this year they've taken two aircraft to the show. Last year they would have the one aircraft on the ground and it would fly for each day of the show. So they're really ramping up their show presence, if you like. Part of that is to emphasize the fact that the airplane is back, it's up, it's in production, and it's being delivered. So the message is very much, you know, we're back in here, we're back on our back on the game sort of thing. And of course, the with the 10X likely, I would say more than likely to be launched before the end of the week, and the 787-9 first flight approaching. You know, this is the time for Boeing to make the absolute most of that sort of show space, as you were.
Let's talk about the Dash 10X a second, because the newspapers here, obviously, the if not the home of Boeing, the sort of ancestral home of Boeing, are very worried about work that is being outsourced, or I guess that's not the right word when it's in the United States, but shipped to Carolina. Right. From here. And the quote from Ray Conner this morning's Seattle Times was not even noncommittal. It just seems that the company really is looking so much at the bottom line that it really is thinking it's going to move all of that new work someplace else.
Well, it is an interesting time for Boeing in that regard, because obviously Charleston is this huge sort of clean sheet facility, if you like, with all of this potential capacity in it. And the curious thing about the 10X is it's such a long airplane. It's 224 feet long when it's finally built, the center section of which, of course, like all the other 787s, will be built in Charleston. And I think part of the issue that Boeing's got there is that under its current way of building the airplane, they build that huge center section and then fly it physically to Everett, where they in the Dream Lifter, which is that converted 747 they use to move the parts around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the 10X, they're kind of challenged on the size of this thing to move it around. So the question is, do you basically build it, put it together finally in Charleston because it's easier to do it like that, or to keep it all in Everett, do you change the way that you make that final center section so that you can fly bits of it separately to the final line in Everett? So, you know, you've got this juggling of, as you quite rightly said, the bottom line. You know, is it sort of easier to do that, or is it simpler to keep it the way it is? And, you know, which is the cheaper option?
It's interesting to think about. And I also, as you were talking, started thinking about the size of these airplanes. The new Airbus Y-Jet, it holds 800 passengers, as I understand, or can hold up to 800 passengers?
Well, the A380, of course, which is their double-deck sort of jumbo that they make, is capable of, in high density seating as many as that. But the A350, which is the one that your correspondent was reporting on, is more like a 787 and 777 size competitor. So it's aimed really at the heart of Boeing's perhaps the biggest part of Boeing's wide body market. And that's going to be a very interesting battle to see how that happens. At the moment, Boeing has the dominant lead in that market, but with the 350, Airbus has got a very viable challenger, I think.
And the 350 also has the carbon fiber body?
It does. Unlike Boeing, which pioneered the use of carbon composites for the fuselage in this sort of one-piece barrel section, Airbus decided, because they saw a lot of the issues that Boeing had initially with that, to make it out of composite, but they're replacing big panel sections on the fuselage with composites and then bolting those panels to frames instead of making it all in one big cooker, like a one big piece barrel.
Hmm.
So there's differences, you know, and that's the weird thing, really, is that Airbus is actually taking advantage, I suppose, of the hard lessons that Boeing learned on the 787.
I was just going to ask you that. Does that apply to batteries as well?
Well, yes, and, you know, they did decide, given what happened with the lithium-ion situation, to go back to NiCad batteries for the 350, although it was too late to change for the prototypes, which will be flying with lithium-ion batteries, which they had, obviously, in lockstep with Boeing, decided were the best for the technology reasons. So, it, you know, I guess from a caution perspective, again, they've learnt that lesson and they've gone back to the old design. But how much of that is for real practical technology purposes and how much of it is for PR and selling to the airline purposes? Perhaps only time will tell.
You know, the other question I have, which is you're going to answer only time will tell, I think, but I'm going to ask it anyway, has to do with the future of passenger flight. Are we talking about ultimately all jet travel being in, you know, 300 people on a plane, 500 people on a plane, 800 people on a plane? Is that it?
Well, it's an interesting question, actually. I think what we've seen so far is that everything is slightly moving up in scale. So even down to the little turboprop type of airliners, like the next generation of those won't be 60-seaters, they'll be 90-seaters. Mm. And it's the same for every sort of category. But in overall number terms, it's still going to be 737 and A320 size 150-seat type of airplanes that the majority of people will be flying in, just from a sheer volume perspective. The bottom line for the whole market, though, is a growth of, you know, over 5%. Generally, this is the sort of rate that you're looking at over the year. So it's just a question of everybody's flying more, and the numbers of actual aircraft will move in lockstep with that.
Hmm. It's fascinating. Guy Norris, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Guy Norris is senior editor at Aviation Week. Today, the first day of the Paris Air Show, Boeing is planning to announce 10 new orders for its 787-10X. This is Weekday.
In a minute, some thoughts on medical malpractice lawsuits from the perspectives of a doctor and a lawyer. That's just moments away.
Support for KUOW comes from KCTS 9, presenting Coal, a documentary about the debate over building coal export terminals in the Northwest. KCTS 9 and Earthfix follow coal's path from Wyoming's open-pit mines to the proposed ports. Coal premieres Wednesday night at 7:30 on KCTS 9 and online.
65 degrees in Seattle. The sky is partly cloudy, partly sunny. Forecast says chance of showers today with a high of 72. Later this hour, Hairspray, the stage show, and how it transformed Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater. That's 20 minutes away.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. What's it like for a doctor to be sued by a patient? Medical professionals do make mistakes. Other times, a patient thinks that a mistake has been made. Both scenarios can lead to a lawsuit. So what advice do lawyers give doctors who are called into court? And are medical lawsuits actually elevating the cost of medical care in the United States? Joining us to talk about it is Phil DeMaine. He's a senior partner with the Johnson Graffey Law Firm. His practice focuses on defending doctors, hospitals, and other healthcare professionals in medical malpractice lawsuits. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
And also joining us from the medical side of things is Jim DeMaine, his Phil's father. He's a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also an emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of the Hospital Ethics Committee. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, Jim, let's start with you as a doctor. Have you ever been sued?
Yes, I would practice in a fairly high-risk specialty, pulmonary and critical care. So often I was caring for patients I had never seen before. I was doing invasive procedures and a lot of end-of-life issues. And actually, I only got sued one time. It was kind of devastating emotionally to be sued because it makes you doubt yourself. You wonder how peers look at you. It's very time-consuming, so it interferes with the daily flow of practice. Yeah, it can be difficult. I can describe the situation.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, I was caring for a patient in the intensive care unit that had a bad outcome. It was a mom with who had just delivered who went into shock postoperatively, and there was some questions about the care she initially got at that point, which was not my responsibility. But she was transferred into the intensive care unit where I participated in her care. All of the pulmonologists were involved because she was in the intensive care unit for months. But part of the care I was involved in, she had an infected central line catheter, and I knew it had to be changed. And in the process of changing, I was quite concerned that she had clot, an infected clot on the end of the catheter. So I decided to anticoagulate her with heparin, which has its pros and cons. Also, I felt she was too ill at that point to move down and have a more definitive procedure to look at the, whether she had clots or not. Long story short, she had some bleeding complications in the brain related to the use of heparin. And in retrospect, perhaps the heparin should have been stopped sooner, or we should have taken her down for more definitive imaging. So those are the questions I have to ask myself. But anyway, it did require depositions from multiple doctors, including myself. The case never went to trial, so at least I did not have to go into a courtroom, which I think would have been an even more traumatizing experience. But it's those kind of things that I think that are common for interventional specialists to face up to the fact that, yes, they are going to get sued. In fact, one piece of data I saw, if you're a general surgeon and you're 60 years old, you're roughly 100% chance that you're going to have been sued during those 60 years. So I think, and if you're a neurosurgeon, it's a 1 in 5 chance every year. So the real high-risk specialties, that's part of life. And it's foreign territory to doctors. Perhaps Phil he talks to doctors that are entering this foreign territory, so perhaps he can comment on that.
Well, and you also said you've only been sued once. Does that mean that more doctors you know are sued multiple times and you got away with only once during your long career?
I think I was lucky. I did try if I saw a bad outcome. I certainly made a lot more mistakes than I ever got sued for. So there isn't a real good correlation between mistakes and lawsuits. You know, one time I did make a serious mistake. I had a bleeding complication from a bronchoscopy that perhaps I shouldn't have done. Kind of a long, complicated course. But the patient subsequently died. And I called his son, who was shocked. He came in and we talked. And it turns out his dad was in a very bad circumstance. He'd been subject to some abuse in a home where he was staying, and now he had to be placed in a nursing home. His quality of life had been suffering. So the son knew that he was getting near the end anyway. But I talked to him. I apologized. I said, you know, I think in retrospect, if I look at this, I should not have done this procedure on your dad. And he kind of looked at me and said, you know, being a doctor must be hard sometimes. And I thought, wow, you know, you let me off the hook. So this is a recommendation that's commonly being made now for doctors to upfront be honest. Everybody wants to duck and run when they've made a mistake. And so I think we have to acculturate ourselves and our systems to be much more transparent and upfront when mistakes are made.
That's Jim DeMaine, retired pulmonary critical care doctor. We're also here with Phil DeMaine, who is a senior partner with the Johnson Graffey Law Firm, who focuses on defending doctors. We're talking about medical malpractice and lawsuits. When you have a lawsuit against a doctor, what are the main reasons for it?
You know, there's a variety of reasons that the lawsuits are brought, but the one thing in common that they all have against doctors is a bad outcome. So it starts with that. And part of the problem that we have as attorneys that defend doctors, as well as the attorneys who bring the lawsuits against doctors, is figuring out which of those lawsuits are truly due to medical negligence or a medical mistake, as opposed to simply a known risk of the procedure or a known complication that can develop. We're all familiar with informed consent forms that we have to sign when we go in for surgery or another procedure. And oftentimes those are really exhaustive in their list to let the patient know that, yes, if you have this surgery, you could bleed to death. You could get an infection. There are a number of things that could happen that could result in a bad outcome. And so when you see a patient, for example, in my last trial, defending a general surgeon who had performed a hernia surgery on an elderly gentleman, and complication occurred that the small bowel got injured. That's a known complication. It's, in fact, in the consent form. So then it came down to, well, was it due to a mistake that the doctor made, or was it due to simply he did nothing wrong, but that's just nature and that sort of thing happens. So there's a variety of situations, but a bad outcome is a commonality in all of them.
How do you decide which cases to accept?
Well, that's an interesting question because one of the jokes I make with the plaintiff's attorneys is they get to choose their cases and I don't. Someone like my dad gets sued, their insurer or if they're an employee of a medical group will call a lawyer like myself and ask them to represent the doctor in the lawsuit. The plaintiff's attorneys, on the other hand, when a patient who's been injured comes into their firm and wants to talk to them about their case, it's a very different mindset because I think I can say that most of the plaintiff's attorneys would agree with me that the most important part of their job is screening their case to really determine if it has merit or not. That can really separate a successful plaintiff's attorney who sues doctors and one that is not successful because these lawsuits are really, really expensive. And when you're a plaintiff's attorney, oftentimes you're spending your own money to do that. And it can add up very quickly.
It seems maybe either one of you could take this on, but if a patient or a patient's family feels like something wrong happened, is there a better course to take than suing somebody? Why do you think lawsuits are the reaction?
You know, there's kind of been an interesting experiment at the University of Michigan hospitals where they actually try to make it totally transparent when something goes wrong. You know, first of all, they encourage apologies. And even in our state, and Phil can verify this, if a doctor calls a patient, a patient's family, let's say after an outcome, or to the patient and say, I'm very sorry, we made a mistake here, and this is what happened, and this is why, that conversation can't be used against the doctor in subsequent lawsuit, so that's kind of protected. But they went beyond that. Let's say if an injury had happened and the representatives from the hospital would immediately come down and discuss the adverse outcome with the patient and offer a settlement, sometimes on the spot. So a lot of the effort is upfront honesty and transparency and then trying to listen and address the concerns of the patient or family and apologize. And I think that's very important psychologically. It's a little harder to sue somebody who's kind of looked you in the eye and said, I'm very sorry, we were trying to do this, but this was the outcome. Their experience is more satisfaction among families that settlements have actually come down and their total costs have come down. That's called kind of the Michigan standard of, and other states have enacted some legislation that begins to approach that.
I guess what I would add to that is that in 2006, when former Governor Gregoire worked with both parties in trying to come up with some legislation to reform the system a bit, two of the big provisions out of that were later deemed unconstitutional by our Supreme Court. But one thing that did come out of that was the opportunity for a physician to make an apology. There's a certain amount of time after the event that a physician can make an apology, and then that the rule is that apology will not be admissible in court if that goes to trial. Because one thing that I worry about as a defense attorney is anything my doctor says to the patient or the patient's family can potentially be talked about in court. So by making that part of the law that it's not admissible in court, it gives doctors the freedom to do that without necessarily worrying about that coming back to bite them at a later time. But, you know, let's make no mistake about it. There are mistakes that are made, and there are people that are injured. There are people that have brain-injured babies due to medical negligence. There are people that die due to medical negligence. So it's not like there aren't legitimate claims out there that need compensation. Our job on the defense side is to try to pick out which one of those are the legitimate ones. There are many. And try to take care of those in the appropriate way by settling those claims. And the ones that usually make it to trial are the ones that we believe that, you know, the doctor did nothing wrong, that the care was appropriate, or that even if they did do something wrong, that it didn't ultimately cause the injury that the patient is complaining of.
What happens to a doctor's reputation if they're sued and maybe sued justly, from your experience, Jim?
Well, I think most of the time people are forgiving. I think we're all human. We all make errors. And if it's correctable or if it's not a repetitive kind of mistake, I think if somebody is getting sued frequently and there are other issues going on, there obviously needs to be an investigation. And Phil, there is a reporting mechanism to the state. And also when we're moving from state to state or we're applying for medical privileges, we have to disclose all that prior experience we might have had with lawsuits. So doctors are certainly scrutinized, reported, and regulated. I'd like to get back to one thing about what goes wrong with medical systems. There's an interesting author at Harvard, Atul Gawande, who wrote a New Yorker piece called The Checklist, and he's written what I think is a great book called The Checklist Manifesto. What he's trying to do is bring quality standards into medical practice. We have wide variation. For example, putting in a central line in the ICU where you have to put a large IV catheter into the neck or under the collarbone. These are very useful in terms of getting medications and support, but they tend to get infected. So they looked and studied why people were getting infected and came up with a standard where the doctor would be fully gowned, the patient would be fully draped, and allowing anybody to shut the procedure down. It's kind of like Toyota, you know, you can shut the assembly line down if a mistake is made. When they enforced this, they saw their infection rate drop dramatically. The problem in medicine is taking that kind of what we call evidence-based medicine or standards and taking it out into the community and having it adopted in multiple places, multiple hospitals. That's where the success story stumbles. I think the latest I heard, they were successful in about 20 or 30% of the hospitals because you get resistance from, you know, senior staff, even administration or others saying, well, we just don't do it that way here. We have great success our own way. So this is a problem within medicine. You know, we kind of need to clean up our act and be willing to share best evidence, ensuring that those standards are really applied across the board.
We often hear that part of the rising cost of medicine and medical treatment is due in part to these lawsuits. And there's lots of factors, obviously, but that lawsuits are a contributor to those costs. Do you think that that's true?
Doctors probably have been doing too many things, probably in the emergency room, let's say, doing MRIs with kids that run into a soccer injury and may have had a concussion. But now there's pretty good evidence that we shouldn't be doing so many MRIs on head injuries in kids. Yes, it has been a cost driver. Ezekiel Emanuel, who gave a course on the Affordable Health Care Act, talked about maybe 2 to 3% of total medical costs are related to defensive medicine. Phil can comment, but I think juries are pretty fair if you're following the standard of practice in the community. So if we can say, yeah, you know, this type of head injury, but they have their totally normal neurologic exam, their community standard would be we do not do an imaging procedure in that situation. So if a doctor is following that and his importantly, his colleagues and community are following that, then I think you're protected. So it's important to look at where doctors may be inappropriately defensive, if you will, and try to correct that. I think those costs can come down.
I guess what I would add to your question is that you're going to have people on both sides of the coin on this, and there are those who feel that tort reform is absolutely necessary with putting caps on damages so that you can't get these multi-million-dollar awards. But at the end of the day, insurance premiums actually in the last few years have been dropping for doctors. They've been reduced, and the two largest insurers in our state have been seeing reductions across the board in premiums. So that's a direct reflection on the state of medical malpractice and the claims and the money that they're being paid out. So I don't know that it would have that much of an impact. I can say that from the clients I've represented, that those, even when we win trials, I've had clients where they, for example, started giving cardiologists giving more angiograms that they probably wouldn't otherwise have ordered, because even though they won the trial, they were worried that they might get sued again because they were accused of not doing an angiogram when one was when you know the plaintiff said it was indicated. So that's the defensive medicine that my dad is referring to, and if we could cut back on some of that, that will always help with the costs.
That's Phil DeMaine. He's a senior partner with the Johnson Graffey Law Firm. His practice focuses on defending doctors and hospitals and other healthcare providers in medical malpractice lawsuits. And Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also an emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of the Hospital Ethics Committee. You can read more from him on his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in to talk about this.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Jim DeMaine and Phil DeMaine spoke with KUOW's Katie Sewell. It's 10:37. One smash hit can transform a regional arts organization. We'll find out how in a minute.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. You can count on KUOW and NPR to provide intelligent reporting that makes you a more knowledgeable person. KUOW's programs take you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper understanding of important issues. Now is the best time to renew your annual KUOW membership or to make a special gift. Please mail your gift in today or give online at KUOW.org. Thank you.
Leon McCarthy was born without fingers on one hand, but now he can do things he never could before.
I'm able to hold a pencil, piece of paper.
With a mechanical hand made by a 3D printer.
It was like, look it, it's working. The Frankenstein hand is functioning. I am holding my lunch bag.
A new hand for kids, Robo Hand, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing transatlanticism, heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
65 degrees and partly sunny in Seattle. Chance of showers today with a predicted high of 72. It's 10:39. I'm Bernard Ouellette.
As it races down the hill, you can try to stop the seasons, girl, but you know you never will. And you can try to stop my dancing feet, but I just cannot stand still. Does the world keep spinning round and round, and my heart keeps in time to the speed of sound? I was lost till I heard the drums, and I found my way. You can't stop the beat.
Well, character Tracy Turnblad from Hairspray, musical based on John Waters' original film, and it just so happened 10 years ago it launched at Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater. Good morning, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Hairspray went on to Broadway and to what Variety used to call boffo box office and critical raves and lots of awards. But what about the Fifth Avenue in the aftermath of that tidal wave of Hairspray? The theater's artistic director, David Armstrong, is here to talk about the Hairspray effect, I should say. Hello. Thanks for coming in. Who pitched Hairspray to you in the first place?
I was friends with some of the producers, the original who had were developing the show in New York when I was in New York prior to coming here to Seattle. So I came here in 2000. And as I was coming here, I spoke to people I knew there and said, I'm going to Seattle, to the Fifth Avenue. I think it's a tremendous opportunity to develop a show, to develop show new musicals. And most new musicals are developed in a partnership between commercial producers and nonprofit companies because they're so big and they're so complex, it's almost impossible to do them any other way. And it's, you know, we get to do the research and development work on these shows. So one of those producers of about a year after I was here, called me and said, we have the show called Hairspray. It's based on the John Waters movie. And it was, you know, now you look back and you think, well, of course you do Hairspray. It's a big, giant hit. But at that time, being based on a John Waters movie was not necessarily a positive.
No. Yeah. So
none of the writers had ever written a show before. It was their first time show. Harvey Fierstein was not a giant star at that point. He was sort of somebody who was kind of known from a few small movie roles. So it was everything about it was speculative.
You had just come to the Fifth Avenue. Was this something the Fifth Avenue did, launch musicals?
They had done it years ago with Jekyll and Hyde, but that had been about 10 years prior. They had gotten involved with that and had gone to Broadway and done well. But they hadn't done it since then. We did a new musical the year before Hairspray called Prince and the Pauper, which is a show that didn't go any further mm-hmm. than the Fifth Avenue. But it was, again, what we usually do is try to get involved with very talented people. You can't predict whether a show is going to go on to any kind of success. And if you try to get in that business, you'll never succeed.
So you get this call, you're here, Hairspray, based on this John Waters movie, and you immediately say, yeah, or do you, what do you need to see?
I need to read the script. I need to hear the music. I went to a reading of the show in New York, and every step along the way just got me very excited about the show. It truly had the potential to be amazing. And in fact, at the reading in New York, when we were trying to make the decision about to do it, I called my partner, who was Marilyn Sheldon at that point, the managing director of the theater, and said, well, if they don't screw this up, this could be a really, really great show. Or if we don't screw it up in the process. So we jumped in the pool and decided we were going to do this. And it was one of those very rare things. We've now done 14 new musicals since then at the Fifth Avenue. But Hairspray is very special because it was one that you just knew from the beginning had all this potential, and it came out of the box nearly perfect, and that's very unusual.
Hmm. Last night on PBS, I was watching a great performances about Broadway theater and sort of traced the history of content of shows and presentation of musicals, particularly, and the fact that these days musicals touch on issues and topics. This does, even though we just played the frothiest, catchiest earworm of a song there, this is about racism.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, I've spoken about this on several occasions, the number one subject of the American musical theater is race. Hmm. There's about 30 musicals that deal with racial relations of various kinds. And people sometimes are surprised to hear that because they think of musicals are these frothy things. But underneath most musicals, and especially with Hairspray, is an issue and a subject matter that we can really identify with and get involved with. And I think musicals have always reflected America. They're our great indigenous American art form, and race has been at the center of our American experience from the beginning of the country. So I think it makes sense that those two things go hand in hand.
We call them Broadway musicals, but as you mentioned, they don't just open on Broadway. So when Rodgers and Hammerstein were writing Oklahoma or South Pacific, how did they make that musical?
They had a different system then, not totally different, but they did what they called out-of-town tryouts. Mm-hmm. And the shows would go, the economics were such in those days, and the shows were contained enough, they were technically simple enough, that you could go to Boston for 4 weeks. And if you wanted to stay a couple more weeks, you just stayed a couple more weeks. And then you went to Philadelphia, and they would go to two or three stops on the way to New York. And it now mostly what happens is shows go to a handful of theaters. There's us. There's the La Jolla Playhouse in California. There's the Old Globe also in San Diego. There's a couple in Chicago that tend to be the theaters of choice that are regional, developmental, nonprofit theaters that partner with commercial producers or do it on our own, which we're doing some of that now as well, to develop these shows. And usually there'll be a sit-down production to work on the show and then a later Broadway production.
Did you have all those skills when you came to Seattle to work at the Fifth Avenue?
I had worked at I'd been the artistic director of a theater in upstate New York where we had done a lot of new work development on a much smaller scale, sort of off-Broadway scale musicals. But I'd been involved with dozens and dozens of new projects over the years in my freelance career as well.
So doing this in Seattle, you mentioned there had been one other new play launch, but this was really new, I would imagine, for the staff of the theater and for the reputation. It was, I think, before your arrival, the Fifth Avenue was a house that touring shows came to, parked for a while, did a couple weeks, and then left, right?
Yeah, to a great extent. Although even then, we were producing a lot. Most people just didn't know it. We were sort of a theater that produced to fill out a season of presented musicals.
Okay.
And we sort of turned that completely around. And now we were a theater that presents to fill out a season of produced musicals that we create right here in Seattle, mostly with Seattle talent actors. And many of them, at least every season, a new work and sometimes two new works in a season.
We're talking with David Armstrong, who is the artistic director, the man who's bringing all this art to Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater. What, aside from willingness, is it a financial commitment for the Fifth Avenue to produce these shows?
It is a financial commitment, although I think it's, in terms of producing one of these shows, the cost of them are much higher, but usually that extra cost. So say if we were going to produce West Side Story, there would be a significant cost to us doing that. We did an acclaimed production of that a few years ago. If you're now going to present a brand new musical, East Side Story, just say for for lack of a better thing, you've now added probably half as much expense to that because of the expense of bringing the authors here, the extra development time it takes, all those kinds of elements that go into it. But very often those extra costs are borne by the commercial producers who have who we call that enhancement money, and basically they enhance the production beyond what we would be able to do on a nonprofit budget. But we basically produce the show, and they sort of hand their baby over to us, and we produce it.
The Fifth Avenue, as you mentioned, there's been, you know, the Hairspray success, and it was, as you mentioned, it was great out of the box. And
it was one of the huge once-in-a-lifetime, you know, success stories.
This is now, I think, as much the identity of the Fifth Avenue a launch pad as it is. I mean, I'm sure there are shows that come in and tour, but it seems like that isn't the identity of the theater anymore.
No, very much our identity now as one of the leading incubators of new musicals in the country. And we were very fortunate to have Hairspray be the first one to sort of put us on the map with that. We were fortunate that the lead producer on that show, Margot Lyon, went back to New York and told all her colleagues what a great experience she had. She basically said, I'm never going to partner with another theater except the Fifth Avenue. And Margot's been back twice since then with other shows that we've worked on. And so that helped sort of start this ball rolling. And then we had great experiences with a number of other producers along the way.
Both the Seattle Rep and Intiman Theater have launched work. And in fact, Intiman launched Light in the Piazza, is a musical of sorts as well.
Absolutely.
But both of those. So what does Seattle as a city, as a community have that Boston or Hartford, Connecticut or Philadelphia don't?
It's an amazing audience. Seattle is really the audience here is the secret ingredient that makes this work. We're one of the three great theater towns in the United States, and I always say that to people in Seattle, and they look at me like I'm crazy because they don't think that could be true. But there's New York, there's Chicago, and there's Seattle, and no other cities come even close. The only possible rivals would be Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Washington, D.C. Nobody else is supporting the quantity and the quality of theater that we have here. We have five major theater companies. We have a whole host of mid-size and small theater companies. And that's their willingness to go to the theater. I don't remember what the latest statistics are, but it's just an overwhelming percentage of our population supports the theater and the arts in a way that most cities, and it has to do with education, it has to do with income level, it's all those kinds of demographic things that go into that. But we're just a theater town, and the audience is willing to come out, and then at the Fifth Avenue, we've worked with the audience. We've provided a lot of inside, behind-the-scenes experience, so they get very excited about the new work, rather than being, oh, I've never seen that. I'm not sure I want to see that. I don't want to take a chance on something new. We've found ways to bring them inside the process and get them very excited about that. And then we've been lucky to have these shows go to New York, so they get excited about that as well.
We have audience. How much work does this provide for local theater artists, not necessarily actors, but all the folks who do the behind the scenes?
And just at the Fifth Avenue, we employ over 800 artists and craftspeople every season. And of our $22 million budget, 3/4 of that money is going right back into the community. It's all paying for artists and craftspeople, stagehands, musicians, actors, singers, dancers.
So it's an industry.
It's an industry. I mean, it's a wonderful industry. It's one of the most satisfying parts of my job is that what we do, every dollar we raise, every dollar we bring at the box office is being used to employ these amazing artists that live and work right here in our community.
So I've lost the number of how many of these musicals you've now launched and sent to New York.
We've done 14 new musicals in 11 years total. To date, 7 of them have gone to Broadway. And one more will open just a few weeks, in August 9th, first date, the show we did in collaboration with ACT last year. Mm-hmm. Great success.
That Bill Berry is directing.
Bill Berry, our producing director, is directing. So that opens on Broadway in August. And then Aladdin, which we did a few years ago, opens next spring on Broadway. So that'll be 9 of the 14 musicals opening on Broadway.
And those are commercial productions. Do you guys get a cut of the earnings?
We do. We get a tiny little piece of the pie. But as part of our negotiation, when we contract to do these shows and to develop them and to take on the large part of the responsibility of making them happen, we end up with a tiny piece. But when the pie gets as big as something like Hairspray, it can be very, very nice.
You mentioned First Date. It's a partnership with ACT Theater. The Fifth Avenue is a big house, a lot of seats. So what does a partnership with a smaller company give you?
Well, for the last 3 years, we have done a show in collaboration with ACT in one of their spaces at the 400-seat theater. We've used both their theaters now with the 3 shows. And what it allows us to do is explore some parts of the repertoire that we couldn't do in the Fifth Avenue Theater. Our theater's too big for some great musicals, you know, some classic shows. We haven't done them yet, but like The Fantastics or we just did Grey Gardens, which would have been too small a show to put in the large theater. And then we do something very unique. I don't think any other theater companies in the world are doing this. We co-produce the show. It's put on both of our subscription season. Our entire audience goes there, and we actually mix the audiences together. We make sure that we don't have like just Fifth Avenue subscribers on one night and ACT subscribers on other nights. We intermix the whole thing, and it's just proving to be a wonderful, wonderful collaboration for both companies.
So you're so cheerful, David Armstrong. What are the challenges that you and your colleagues face?
The biggest challenge is just paying for it all, is really what it boils down to. It's everybody's challenge, I think. We have been relatively very successful in what we do in all our aspects. But still, from a fundraising and from a ticket sales standpoint, every year we are working very, very hard to make sure we can balance our budgets and do the scale of work that we want to do.
You mentioned this is something that faces everybody because the recession hit everybody, but it hit nonprofit or arts organizations particularly hard because a lot of the public funding has dried up,
yeah,
as
exactly.
Well as some of the corporate dollars. So when you are thinking about, well, gosh, how do we sustain this? What models come to your mind in the middle of the night?
Well, we've been a little fortunate in some ways because we came from a history of depending very heavily on ticket sales as opposed to on contributed income. And we've actually really only put a large focus on fundraising over the past 10 years or so. So we've been able to skin the cat a little differently. We have to increase our fundraising, but we're going to still end up in an ideal world, we would have 80% earned income, as they call it.
Which are ticket sales,
and 20% contributed income. Whereas many theaters are looking at a 60-40 split, and opera companies and ballets are looking at 60-40 in the opposite direction, with 60% in contributed income. So we have our challenges, but our challenges are slightly different.
Well, let's jump back to Hairspray. They used to talk about shows with legs. I don't know if they use that term anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Is Hairspray a show with legs?
It's been an amazing show. I mean, it went to Broadway. It's been produced all around the world. It then became a major motion picture starring John Travolta. It's the highest grossing movie musical in history.
Hairspray is?
Hairspray is. Surprisingly, surprised me too. Of course, it has to do a lot with ticket prices, you know, but compared to, you know, Singing in the Rain or something like that back in the 50s. But still, a huge achievement that this little show that started sort of this unlikely musical that started at the Fifth Avenue Theater, went to Broadway, went around the world, went to the movies, and now we're bringing it back in this sort of 10th anniversary concert production.
Now, I just have to ask you, what is a concert production as opposed to a production?
A concert production is done with much more simple staging, and it has to be simple because we have the 150 members of the Seattle Men's Chorus on stage with us, and a full orchestra, so there'll be about more than almost 300 cast members on stage.
Will there be the script of the show itself?
We will do all the dialogue. The whole script will be there, but very simple, you know, scenic elements. We'll do some costuming, so it'll be and with very simple staging.
Well, you can see that it's a very short run. It's just this weekend, the 20th through the 23rd, at the Fifth Avenue Theater. And David Armstrong, we look forward to what's next, Aladdin?
On Broadway?
On Broadway.
Well, first date this summer, and then Aladdin next fall. And then the same, we're opening our 15th new musical at the Fifth Avenue. We'll open next season, Secondhand Lions, based on the popular movie, by the same writers as First Date.
Well, there you have it. David Armstrong is Artistic Director of Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater, and we're going to go out with some music from Hairspray, but I just want to say, because you won't want to stop playing it, you'll be dancing around just like Tracy Turnblad. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Alsadi. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the big one, the 9.0 earthquake, with Seattle Times reporter Sandy Doughton. So you can't stop that. You can't stop this either.
You can't stop an avalanche as it races down the hill. You can try to stop the seasons, girl, but you know you never will. And you can try to stop my dancing feet, but I just cannot stand still. Cause the world keeps spinning round and round, and my heart keeps in time to the speed of sound. I was lost till I heard the drums, then I found my way. You can't stop the beat. Ever since this whole world began, a woman found it. She shook and she can shake up a man. So I'm gonna shake and shimmy at the best that I can today. You can't stop the motion of the ocean or the sun in the sky. You can wander if you wanna, but I never ask why.
Music from Hairspray on KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 10:59. The U.S. Supreme Court says no to a Seattle police officer's request. KUOW's Lisa Brooks explains in the news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Specialty Natural Medicine, with more than 40 years combined experience in natural and conventional treatment, specializing in food allergy resolution, family and digestive medicine. Learn more at specialtynaturalmedicine.com.
He's suddenly become the world's third most famous leaker after Manning and Snowden, Daniel Ellsberg, on the risk of revealing state secrets.
Breaking your promise to keep secrets does have a lot of risk. That deters most people from giving priority to their oath to the Constitution.
Watching the U.S. Constitution next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
You'll want to hear that this afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Zoo Tunes, presenting John Prine, June 23rd, John Hyatt with Holly Williams.